The Pre-K through 12 Appropriations Subcommittee will come to order. Kiva, will you please call the roll?
Chair Tomko?
Here.
Vice Chair Tuck? Ranking Member Williams?
Here.
Representatives Alvarez?
Here, ma'am.
Bracy Davis?
Here.
Kennedy?
Here.
Daly?
Here.
Daniels?
Here.
Dunkley?
Here.
Garcia? Gonzalez Pittman?
Present.
Lopez?
Here.
Michael?
Here.
Rizzo? Temple?
Here.
A quorum is present, Madam Chair.
A quorum being present, I want to welcome everyone to the Pre-K through 12 Appropriations Subcommittee. Please make sure that your cell phones and other communication devices are turned off or on silent mode. Well, good afternoon, members, and welcome to our first regular session subcommittee meeting. We have one general bill, CS for House Bill 223, on agenda, and then we will move into a discussion and workshop on updating the Florida Education Finance Program. So first, we will start with our bill, and Representative Bartleman, you are recognized to explain your bill.
Thank you, Chair Tomko. I appreciate it. Thank you, Ranking Member Williams, Vice Chair, Representative Tuck, and I want to thank Denise because she helped me with this bill, her and Jason Fudge. So let me tell you a little bit about this bill. This bill was requested by parents of students with disabilities, and it allows the parent of a student with a disability who is enrolled in a pre-kindergarten class funded by the Florida Education Finance Program to be retained in pre-K. Okay, so let me tell you what this means. It's very complicated. Dan's got me nervous. He gave me a time frame. So I'm going to, but I have to give you, like, I was going to give you the technical, but I'm going to make it very easy, okay? So this bill creates a pathway for students with disabilities with developmental delays to have their needs best met. It encourages parental choice. It encourages ensuring that the child gets a strong foundation before they enter kindergarten. And this idea came to me because there's a little girl named Anna. And Anna is a student with Down syndrome. And her mother came to me and she was faced with a decision. Do I or do I not retain Anna in pre-kindergarten? She doesn't have the skills. She doesn't have the skill set needed for kindergarten. Do I? You know what? I'm just going to go the way I do it. I was trying to fast it, and I'm not fasting it. Okay. So this is what happened. Anna has a Down syndrome. She has a global developmental disability. Okay. You know what a developmental disability is. A child with a developmental disability does not walk at the same pace as other children. Does not talk. Does not crawl, etc. Right. They are by definition behind. So many of these children receive an IEP when they're 3 years old. They go into a pre-kindergarten exceptional student education class, and they receive services. What happens, though, is that even though they are in that pre-kindergarten ESE class full-time for a year, they have not caught up. So they do not have the communication skills, the executive functioning skills, and the skill set needed to be promoted to kindergarten. So you have to make a decision. My kid is not ready to go to kindergarten. In kindergarten, it's not the kindergarten of our day where we played and we had fun. It's a kindergarten where it's rigorous, where it has a higher pupil-to-teacher ratio, where there's testing. So if you send a child into that classroom who is not fully prepared, they will fall even further behind. And so what happens to these parents is, in third grade, no child in the state of Florida gets out of third grade without passing a reading test. You can be retained up to 2 times in third grade if you do not pass that reading test. So a child with a disability, however, has something called a good cause exemption in the state law under the pupil progression. What the good cause exemption does is it says that as long as they have an IEP, an intensive instruction, they only have to be retained once in kindergarten, first, second, or third grade, and then they are promoted to fourth grade, okay? But what happens is to parents like Anna is she's like, it's not a good idea to send my kid to kindergarten. Anna doesn't have the foundation. Anna is not ready. She is going to be even further behind if I put her in kindergarten. But I know that if I don't put her in kindergarten, if I retain her in pre-K, she's going to be retained again a second time in K1, 2, or 3. That's 2 retentions for a child before they're 8 years old. So all this bill is going to do is change the pupil progression plan so that if I'm a parent and I sit down with my IEP team and I decide that it would be educationally sound and it would be the best decision to keep Anna in pre-K, that I can do it and that pre-K retention counts towards good cause promotion. I have an educator, Representative Temple. Everyone knows the data. The earlier you retain a child, the better the outcomes. You retain a child in pre-K, it's much easier than K-1, 2, or 3 because the social implications. The child, like Anna with Down syndrome, she has a peer group around her. She has friends. She's developing social skills. She loses all of that when she has to be retained. And by the way, most of these students by fourth grade, they're going to switch to an alternative curriculum anyway, and they're not going to be getting a standardized diploma. So this bill is about empowering parents and empowering educators to do the best thing, to make the best decisions for their children based on that child's individualized needs. That's why you have an IEP, an individualized education plan. Special education is not one size fits all. And when a student and a parent, when a parent is making a decision about their child and where they need to be, this will give them the ability to make a sound, good educational decision without the fear of being retained twice. Thank you. That was totally off script. I tried to be really fast for you, Daly.
You did a great
job. Thank you.
Seeing no amendments, are there any questions for Representative Bartleman on the bill? Seeing no questions, we have some people who are wishing to testify. We have Hillsborough County Public Schools waving in opposition. Huh? We have Michelle Watson, Florida Alliance. I think they were waving in support. I am sorry.
No, it's okay.
I don't even have the excuse that it's early, so it's late, guys.
Thank you, Chair. Okay. I was like, I'm going to.
Sorry about that. Michelle Watson with Florida Alliance of Children Councils and Trusts, waving in support. Margaret J. Hooper with Florida Developmental Disabilities. Waving in support. Victoria Zepp, self, waving in support. I apologize for all of that. Members, is there any debate? Representative Daly, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say a quick thank you. I know Representative Bartleman, I didn't mean to get you a little startled. I was only joking, but I appreciate the time and effort that you put into this because it's a really important issue, and certainly take as much time as you need always for something like this, and I'm proud to support it. Thank you.
Representative Bracey Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you so much, Representative, for your thoughtfulness. I echo the sentiments of Rep. Daly. Thank you for doing this on behalf of Anna and many other special needs and differently abled children. Thank you for this bill.
Representative Temple, you're recognized.
Thank you for bringing this bill before us. There are Annas all over the state, and I've worked with many of them throughout the years, and this is going to help a lot of families moving forward. And I'm sure there's a lot of educators, especially special ed educators, that will be very thankful for this bill. So thank you.
Any further debate? Seeing none, Representative Bartleman, you are recognized to close on your bill.
I'm going to wave close and thank the chair, respectively, and all the committee members for your support. And thank you for making a difference for all the Annas out there.
Representative Bartleman, having closed on the bill, Kiva, will you please call roll?
Chair Tomko?
Yes.
Vice Chair Tuck?
Yes.
Ranking Member Williams?
Yes.
Representatives Alvarez?
Yay.
Bracey Davis?
Yes.
Kennedy?
Yes.
Daly?
Yes.
Daniels?
Yes.
Dunkley?
Yes.
Garcia? Gonzalez-Pittman?
Yes.
Lopez? Michael?
Yes.
Rizzo?
Yes.
Temple?
Yes.
13 yeas, 0 nays, Madam Chair.
Members, by your vote, show CS for House Bill 223 will be reported favorably. Congratulations, Representative Bartleman. Members, I'm going to give us a second to get ready for the presentation real quick. We all good? All right. So, members, as we start our next agenda item, I want to explain how I would like for this to work. Since this is a discussion and workshop on updating the FEFP, your participation is genuinely needed. I have 6 slides to help guide us through our discussion, and I will periodically pause between slides to ask for your thoughts, questions, and input, so please engage. So starting with the first slide, we spent the month of February learning and talking about the fiscal aspects of school choice. the FEFP and funding school choice in the FEFP. These interim meetings have provided information to lay groundwork that the state's 50-year-old funding model needs to be updated. So today, let's begin that discussion. In February, we talked about the FEFP and learned that it is comprised of two main parts, the base FEFP funding and categoricals. Remember, the base FEFP funding represents over 60% of the total funds provided in the FEFP, and that the calculation of the base FEFP is based on the school district's total number and types of students. Categoricals are individual allocations in the FEFP and represent the biggest challenge to funding school choice in the FEFP. Why is that? Well, as we also learned in February, there are two types of categoricals: those that have either a district or school eligibility requirement, and those that have a statutorial established funding policy that directs how the funds must be spent. While both types of categoricals are included in the calculation of the scholarship amount, neither the eligibility requirement of funding policies apply to the scholarship students, and that's what makes this challenging. So let's stop here and see what thoughts, questions, or comments you may have on categoricals and updating the FEFP.
Madam Chair, can you explain the two different categories again? You said district, one is for district, and the other one is how it is actually spent.
So the first one is those that have either a district or school eligibility requirement, and the second is those that have a statutorial established funding policy that directs how the funds must be spent. So that's in statute. Representative Kennedy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if categoricals make funding so challenging, why not fund choice scholarship students outside of these categoricals? And I think I've heard that referred to as funding below the line.
Yeah, so thank you for that question. Overall, the philosophy is to have a state funding model that aligns with the state's educational choice model. Funding outside of the FEFP or the below the line is what you have heard would mean that the implementation of the state's educational choice model is limited by the amount of funds appropriated by the legislature. And so when the Gardner Scholarship Program was funded outside of the FEFP, members expressed much concern about the wait list and then the need for parents and activists to come up to come to Tallahassee and advocate for an increase in the program's funding. So we would be taking a step backwards if we fund the Family Empowerment Program to include students with disabilities outside of the FEFP. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we've heard a lot, and I've heard a ton, about the Arizona funding model for the universal school choice. Can you kind of go over how they fund their scholarship program?
Absolutely. Thank you for that question. I've heard that a lot as well when having conversations. And Arizona currently funds its program outside of the equivalent of our FEFP. So there's a base amount appropriated by the Arizona legislature. And once they have reached that funding capacity, advocates at that point must lobby the legislature in order to appropriate additional funds to that program.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
So if we use the same model that Arizona uses to fund it outside of the FEFP, that means this will have its own line item, or it still would be the same?
It would not be in the FEFP, so that dollar amount, like I said, there would be a set amount. But then every year, like we do when it comes to appropriations and bringing through the process, we would have to have that set amount. And then if it needed to be an increase at that point, there would have to be advocacy in order to bring that up. Representative Temple.
Yep. If we were to eliminate some of the categoricals, how would we handle the underlying policies that are associated with those categoricals?
Yes, so that has been a conversation that we've continued to have in this committee, and I know has been a concern of each and every one of you as well. So when we do that, we would still retain the underlying policy of those categoricals. And for example, there is a reading instruction allocation categorical that, among other things, requires school districts to develop and implement a comprehensive system of reading instruction. And so this policy would be retained in statute, and any other similar categorical would be as well. So they would still receive funds. They would just be in the underlying policy.
Follow up. So I've been in discussions. School districts for a long time wanted flexibility in how to utilize their operational budgets. Would doing this, would addressing the categoricals in the FEFP provide those districts flexibility?
Absolutely. That is the number one feedback that we hear from the districts, actually. And while still requiring the school districts to comply with what is the statutorial established policies, the districts would be determining the amount of their base FEFP funding that they must spend in order to be in compliance. All right. Any further? Oh, we'll move on to the next. So moving on to more specific issues within the base FEFP funding is the district cost differential, or the DCD. And as you'll recall, the DCD is used to address the impact of geographic location on wages across Florida school districts. And over the years, there has been much discussion about the need to thoroughly analyze the DCD and potentially make some changes. The most recent discussion has centered around how the DCD has not been updated to align with the law that establishes a minimum base salary of $47,500 for all full-time classroom teachers, regardless of the geographic location of the school district. So again, I'll pause here and ask for your thoughts on and comments when it comes to the DCD. Representative Williams.
Madam Chair.
Or Ranking Member Williams, I'm sorry about that.
Will this, if we make the changes, will this align with the law to establish the minimum amount of salary base? And who would have the opportunity or the decisions of changing the salary that is currently at?
Yes, so you could set any salary level in law, but this would align to the current salary level that we have.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
You said we could set, meaning the legislators or the school districts?
The legislature.
Thank you.
Sorry about that. Representative Alvarez, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in looking at the DCD, how is it used, how is the FEFP used to calculate the base funding for that?
Yes, so the base FEFP is determined by multiplying the unweighted FTE by their appropriated program cost factor, and then multiplying the weighted FTE by the district's DCD and the BSA. And if a school district has a DCD that is less than 1.0, then it's essentially its number of FTE is being reduced.
Can I have a follow-up, ma'am?
Yes.
All right, so, because this one I found interesting. So it's 47, I wrote it down, $47,500 for the minimum, or for the what the teachers are going to make. How many districts are at that level? How many districts have met the minimum level?
Yes. So prior to the statutory requirement of the 47.5, there was only one district, Monroe, that was at or above this amount. For fiscal year 21 to 22, I'm sorry, there are now 13 school districts that have minimum base salaries for their full-time classroom teachers that exceed 47.5. 19 school districts at the 47,500, and 42 that are still less than the 47,500. Oh, yes, sorry, I'll go through those numbers again. So 13 school districts that have a minimum base salaries for their full-time classroom teachers that exceeds $47,500. And 19 school districts at the 47,500 500,000, and then 42 that are still less than 47.5.
Thank you, ma'am.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
General question. We, last session, we stated that the minimum amount of teacher for 47.5, and we're seeing now that 42 districts is still under the 47.5. Did we not give money to make that?
Yes, so in the past 3 years, we've increased in the categorical the number of school districts that have gotten the teacher salary to 47.5.
Madam Chair?
You're recognized.
In the budget itself, was it not approved that at that particular time, or did we set a date that they have to bring the teachers to the 47.5?
There was no date associated with that. Okay, if it's okay with you guys, we're gonna move on to the next one. So, and finally, we've talked a lot about how within the FEFP, the funds follow the student. The FEFP is calculated 5 times throughout the fiscal year, and each calculation results in an adjustment made to each school district's FEFP distribution. Perhaps the most important time the FEFP is recalculated is after the completion of the October FTE survey, which we had discussed in a previous committee, because this survey compares the forecasted number of FTE to the actual number of FTE. However, current state statute or statute states that a certain type of FTE is essentially capped at the number included in the first calculation of the FEFP, and any additional students counted during a subsequent FTE survey are funded as basic students and not at their appropriate program cost factor level. So do we have any thoughts or questions on that?
Yes, Madam Chair.
You're recognized.
The ones that's counted after the fact at a base set amount, what is that amount?
It's whatever's in the GAA. I was going to say Chair Rizzo, Representative Rizzo. Sorry about that.
Thank you for the bump, Chair. Thank you. Going back to slide 6, what are the types of FTE that are not funded at their appropriate cost factors?
Yes. So for the 7 different education programs that are established in statute, they're organized into 2 groups. And group 1 is the basic education programs, and group 2 is the exceptional programs that include the ESE levels and the English for speakers of other languages, or the ESOL students, and then grades 9 through 12 when it comes to the career education students.
Follow up? Thank you. And do we know why why are they not funded at their appropriate levels?
So there is a statute that caps these FTE at their appropriated amount. So if a district that has an increase in this type of FTE after the October FTE survey, they are funded as basic students at that point. And when we asked why, the only answer that we were able to receive is there must have been a school district issue that needed to be corrected.
Thank you.
Representative Gonzalez-Pittman, you are recognized.
So would this committee have the power to override that?
Yes. Keep forgetting to turn my microphone on. This going in between is a little difficult. Sorry about that, you guys. But I appreciate all of your input and just want to leave you with this one final slide. Any change to the FEFP will always produce the same result. There will always be winners and losers. The overall goal for updating the FEFP is to, 1, address the subcommittee's identified issues, and 2, to eliminate any negative fiscal impact to school districts and scholarship students. So I just thank each and every one of you for being so engaged as we've had these ongoing conversations when it comes to what we're going to be producing in this committee, and appreciate your feedback and your willingness to learn and engage. But this concludes our committee agenda for today. So I really thank you for your great work. And if there's no further business before the committee, Seeing none, Representative Daley has been eager to get out of here. He moves we rise, and without objection, the meeting is adjourned.